This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Dawn, mid-April. The sun rising on the cold ground sends steam into the air and crystallizes the breath of the men lining up on the town green in Lexington. Their muskets lie heavy on their shoulders. The energy is palpable. The British are approaching, and the outnumbered colonial militiamen nervously line up. Suddenly, a cell phone rings, and the man standing at the edge of the green turns to take the call. Wait, what? Well, such is life when you're a historical reenactor, the modern world intruding on your recreation of the past. A similar clash will happen this weekend at the commemoration of the St. Albans Raid, the northernmost act of the Civil War. Reenactors have been rehearsing for months to perform for families with strollers, smartphones, and minivans. So why do they do it? What's the attraction to being a reenactor? Well, today we're going to get some insight into the phenomenon and talk with some local folks who are fascinated by history and can share what they've learned from reenacting key moments in our nation's past. Let's start with the St. Albans Raid, though, and talk with Admiral Warren Hamm, who's co-chair of the 150th anniversary of the St. Albans Raid Committee. Hello, Admiral Hamm. Nice to talk with you.
Yes, good afternoon. Likewise.
So you better give us our history lesson first. Can you give us just like the thumbnail version of the raid?
Okay. The actual raid took place 19 October 1864. At that time, basically, the South was losing the war. And they wanted to do some things to distract the people on the front lines down there, and also to retaliate to the north because of General Sherman's march to the south. There were quite a few Confederate POWs in Canada. So these were organized, and they thought if they could conduct raids at 10 localities along the northern border, that might cause a disruption. St. Albans was the only raid that materialized. And about 23 Confederates infiltrated into St. Albans. And on the 19th of October, they conducted the so-called raid. The idea was to knock off the banks, get as much money as they could, kill as many people as possible, and burn the town. When all said and done, they got about $235,000, which is a fair amount of money,
mm-hmm.
killed one person, and did not burn anything. they exited the town and went back across the border. There was quite a few Union troops home on leave or discharged, and they formed a posse, and they chased the rebels across the border and captured quite a few of them. The big problem was it was armed pursuit across the international border. In anybody's world, that's a big no-no.
Right.
And the repercussions of that were actually worse than the raid, because the UK almost severed relations with the North, and that would have been a disaster.
So, Admiral Hamm, I understand, you know, in this reenactment, you're going to be doing some of the big action and sort of livening it up for people who want to watch and understand this history. But as you said, going across the international border with an armed raid, you know, not crossing at customs, not a great idea. So what are you actually going to be doing this weekend?
We are going to portray, we built five facades that depicting the buildings, hotels, and the banks. And the actors had been rehearsing for months, and we picked out certain scenarios that were sort of stood out in the raid, and we are going to reenact those. And this is going to be projected up on a mega screen so everybody will be able to see it. We want the people to try to get some historical thing out of what took place or what takes place on this reenactment, so it all falls into their idea of what took place in St. Albans.
But you're also having ways for people who aren't actually the actors on this reenactment stage to get involved and even to dress in period costume and feel like they're part of history.
Yes. We have numerous things going to take place. The reenactors are camped out in the park and are going to have daily camp life. We have a mayor's ball in which everybody dresses up in period clothes. We have a reenactment of the actual trial at the courthouse. We have a church service in St. Luke's with the 1864 liturgy. And we have children's games that were typical of that period of time all through the park.
What about food?
Oh, yes, the restaurants are aboard and having period-type food.
So what does that taste like? What's the menu?
As strange as it sounds, one of it is macaroni and cheese. They do a different way of preparing the macaroni, I guess.
So, yeah, presumably not out of a blue box.
That's right. That's right. Stouffer's, yeah.
And you've had townspeople who have actually been working on making period clothes for the mayor's ball.
We have a young lady. Well, we've had several lectures over the last year and a half on how Linda Retzger told people how to do this. And then we have a gal, Cindy Ledbetter, who's actually making clothes for people. And we have this mayor's ball in which the women are all being in period clothes, and we've sold out, which is amazing.
So do you think people have an appetite for this, to feel like they're a part of history, not just learn about it?
Oh, yes. I think that's so important. I think this is a good first step to actually home in on this raid and let it branch out from that. It'd be neat if other people would grab on this and carry it on. I mean, two of us, the chairs, we're 85, so.
So you need a younger generation to take over.
We can't worry about it 50 years from now.
Yeah, that should be a huge one. The 200th anniversary would be pretty huge.
Yeah.
Admiral Warren Hamm is co-chair of the 150th anniversary of the St. Albans Raid Committee, and that reenactment is this weekend in St. Albans. We'll put a link up at vpr.net for people who want to get more information. Admiral Hamm, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure, and hope to see you there.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's going to be good.
Well, we are talking today about military reenactment, the St. Albans Raid, one of the reenactments happening around Vermont, around our area right now and in the future. And we'd love to hear from you. If you're somebody who participates in reenactment, and if you research historical moments and act out the events of the past, if you know what period costume actually looks like and what it takes to hand sew it, give us a call. Tell us about your experiences. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts at vpr.net. Steve Smith is a member of the Champlain Valley Historical Reenactors, and in his capacity as a reenactor, he's the commanding officer of the 2nd Mississippi of the 9th Battalion of the Army of Northern Virginia, active during the Civil War. Steve Smith, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be here.
So, sounds like fun in St. Albans this weekend.
Oh my gosh, yes, it's going to be fun no matter what. Rain or shine, we're going to have a great time. Warren hit the nail on the head for sure.
So you'll be there?
Oh yeah, yeah, I'm going to be there. I'm not going to be participating like I normally would because I'm kind of a little bit under the weather after having back surgery a few weeks ago, but I'll be there helping keep everything straight and running and such.
So you're also an expert in Civil War reenactment, and that's your area of focus.
I've been doing it for about 14 years, yeah.
Why? Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah.
Because it's fun. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's fun. It's an adventure. And I'm with a bunch of folks who share the same passion. And I think that's first and foremost. You know, we all share a very deep and enthusiastic passion for history in general, and specifically the Civil War, you know, because it's such a compelling period in our nation's history. And when we go to these events, we get a chance to share our knowledge, our expertise, if you will. And it's really a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to talk to people. It's a lot of fun to see, you know, the look in their eyes when they realize, like, for example, a lot of folks didn't realize that the raid actually happened in St. Albans. They didn't know that St. Albans was actually, you know, one of the key places and why it even occurred. So when you connect with people that way, that's a moment. That's a real good, special feeling. You feel like you're really helping, you know, increase people's awareness, you know. So I think that's a good thing. And then when we go to the bigger events, the national events, well, that's a whole other ball game right there, but an adventure for sure.
Well, yeah, you were at Gettysburg, I understand, last year, and there were thousands and thousands of reenactors. That must be a totally different scene than something like the St. Albans Raid.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, not only was there probably about 10,000 reenactors, there's probably 30,000 spectators.
So. Yeah, not the same in your normal reenactments.
No,
<here.
laughs> no. But, you know, they're – you know, we we get with the public, meet the public and talk to them about everything, work with kids, and certainly get a lot of enjoyment out of that. And then when you go to the big events, well, that's where, you know, you get a chance to kind of go back in time.
Hmm.
You know, when you see that long line of blue, because naturally I'm lined up across the field on the gray ranks. When you see that long line of blue and it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of guys dressed as Union soldiers. And for that brief moment, it's 1863, you know, and it happens. You really feel like you're back in time for, and that's why we call it the moment. You know, it does.
So does your heart start to beat fast? I mean, do you get that adrenaline rush?
Well, yes, you do, because it's definitely excitement. You know, when you're out there in the ranks and you're moving around and you're trying not to make a mistake, because, you know, maneuvering the guys here and there from point A to point B is you have to listen. It's noisy. Sometimes it gets chaotic. And that's another reason why when you read the history books, and I mean really dig and you find out why things happened then the way they did. And then when you get out there in a reenactment and you're moving, you know, your company or your battalion from one point to the other, and you're trying to coordinate with other people, other units, hundreds, you know, and the things sometimes don't happen the way they're supposed to, which is what happens in real life. You talk [S2] Right. [S1] To any military person, they'll say that plans just go right out the window as soon as the action starts. And of course, we're not shooting at anybody, so we don't have to worry about that, of course. That's a big difference, [S2]
Yeah.
[S1] Obviously. But yeah. I mean,
but don't you ever get the feeling, I mean, when you're commanding your men, don't you ever want to say, guys, this was a really stupid strategy in the 1860s. Come on over here. We're going to go this way. We're going to turn the flank over here, and we are going to rout those northern jerks.
Well, yeah, there are times when we do kind of go, well, why did they do that? And the truth is we have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, 150 years later. You know, we can see what happened. And yeah, it's easy to say, well, if they had just gone around to the right, you know, like we always will be at an event and we'll mimic the lines from Gettysburg, the movie, you know, if it just gone around to the right, you know, we'd have been good, you know. But yeah, we get out there and no, you can see how things can easily get confused. You can see how the mistakes happen, especially when you're maneuvering and it's dark. You can't see. You don't know who's in front of you. You think you know, but you don't really know, because odds are maybe the other folks that were supposed to be where they're supposed to be are not there. So that happens quite often.
We're talking today about historical reenactment, military reenactment, and we're hearing from a lot of you who have experience with this and have been sharing your thoughts with us. Carol says, for years, almost all of my family have been Revolutionary War reenactors. Setting up in camp is akin to moving an entire house. My husband used his muzzle-loading rifle in skirmishes, and he did some of the cleaning of it with a kettle of hot water at camp. He did the intensive cleaning in our bathtub. Boy, sooty, stinky bathtub ring. We loved every minute of it, from teaching the public about our early history to the making of lifelong friends. After several days of being in the first person, one really comes to appreciate present-day amenities. I'm getting a lot of thoughts on that, the appreciation for history that you get. Charles says there really is no substitute to understand the century and a half old letters, diaries, and memoirs than experiencing the emotions of participating in a reenactment with thousands of others doing the same. Of course, the fear of being wounded, crippled, or killed cannot be replicated, and one cannot experience anywhere near the sacrifices of those who were actually there. However, a reenactor can no longer examine a Civil War personality or event through rose-colored glasses without being in awe of those sacrifices. And another person here, Jonathan, says, I've been a living historian and Civil War reenactor for more than 17 years. Reading in a book about history can provide the facts and figures, but putting on a pair of leather-soled brogans and marching in column of four wide on dusty roads towards the battlefield, firing a musket until the barrel is so hot you can't touch the metal, enduring 107 degrees in July in Virginia while in dark wool fatigue coat, and metering out the remaining water in your canteen, being awakened to musket fire on a cold October morning, all provide insight to what a soldier's life was like. As part of the Champlain Valley Historical Reenactors, we have worked to educate school children and the public on the Civil War through history that is up close and personal.
Mm.
I see you nodding.
Oh, absolutely. Everything I just heard you read there, we've experienced countless times.
And that's what brings you back to do it again and again and again. I mean, we heard from Carol that it's like moving house when you try to set up camp. It must take a lot of energy.
Yeah, it's a consuming hobby for sure. That's for sure. Sometimes a little bit too consuming because literally, you know, summers up here in the North Country are short. And you could go from weekend to weekend, from event to event to event. Sometimes you drive as far south as Georgia or North Carolina or Virginia or Pennsylvania. Sometimes you're close as 3-hour drive up here over to the Adirondacks, you know, upstate New York or over to Maine. Either case, you're going to be driving and you got to load up, take everything you need, all the stuff, all the camp stuff, food for the weekend. You want to be so totally, you know, self-sufficient. So, yeah, it's a lot of work.
Let's go to Mike, who's calling in from Wallingford. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having the show. It's pretty neat because I've been doing Revolutionary War reenacting for about 40 years now. And I listened to Steve and a couple of other comments, and, yeah, I'm standing here nodding and smiling. Yeah, it's all of that. One kind of comment I wanted to make about the moving house thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us do, I don't know, there's different names for it. It's hardcore, but it's carrying everything you need on your back. It eliminates all that moving house kind of thing. There's a lot of events where we go to, we walk in with our packs and blankets, spread it out, and we're done. At the end of the event, about 10 minutes later, we roll everything up and walk away.
Is that you, Mike? Are you one of those guys?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of fun. It gives you a little bit different perspective on what the soldiers went through, because for the most part, these guys were moving, and I think Steve mentioned that, you know, carrying everything that they have, you know, on their back. Not much went on the wagons, you know, for the private soldier. But anyways, one of the main reasons I do the reenacting is one to honor the our forebears. I do Revolutionary War. I'm 90 years earlier than Steve. But I look at it as one way to honor the forebears. Our forebears is we're giving them a sense of immortality. You know, each of us, even today, you know, we still look for that some element of immortality in our lives. Maybe only look at it for a couple of minutes, but we still search for immortality at some point. And I know in researching the unit that I've represented for so many years, I look at these guys and I know they never thought that I'd, you know, anybody be looking at their name 200 years down the road. But I look at it as I'm giving them a sense of immortality. I've had some articles published, and, you know, I hope somebody does that for me.
Mike,
you know,
what
after I'm gone.
What a nice sentiment. What a way to put it. This immortality for men who fought 200 years ago, and this sense of place and thinking about your own mortality. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective. I appreciate it. Hearing from many others today as well as we talk about historical reenactment, why reenactors do it, what kind of research goes into it, and what it's like to actually be out on the battlefield. If you have an experience that you'd like to share, or if you have a question about it, call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we are learning about the draw of historical reenactment with Steve Smith, a member of the Champlain Valley Historical Reenactors, and the commanding officer of the 2nd Mississippi of the 9th Battalion of the Army of Northern Virginia, active during the Civil War. If you have a story to tell about reenactments you've participated in or watched, or if you want to ask a question about what motivates reenactors, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Marnie who says 3rd and 4th grade students at Bridport Central School had an amazing experience when the director of education at Fort Ticonderoga asked if they would be willing to participate in a reenactment of the capture of Fort Ty by the Green Mountain Boys on opening day for the fort in 2004. Appropriate costumes were created by parents, action mapped out and practiced, lines memorized, and on that particular date, everyone was transported back in time as the student reenactors stormed through the tunnel and surprised the British soldiers garrisoned at the fort. An unforgettable memory, Marnie says. And Carol writes, my husband and I have been reenacting for about 30 years. Our time period is the French and Indian War. The reason we love living history is that it harks back to the childhood games, forts, cowboys and Indians, exploring, etc. As adult reenactors, it's the same, except we have all the accoutrements and fun people to play with, too. Again, share your thoughts with us. Write them down. Send them to vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. Steve Smith, what about kids? How can kids get involved in reenactment?
Well, it's good that you brought that up, because as we were listening to Mike talk about his authentic portrayal, we have that same thing. We kind of, it's one of those kind of, there's two schools of thought. There's the authentics who want to be as authentic and as accurate as possible, down to the stitches and the threads that they're using, the buttons that they put on the uniforms and all.
So, like, no Dr. Scholl's inserts in your shoes?
Absolutely not. And then there are the others that are more mainstream. And one of the things that kind of is part of the mainstream is the family aspect, because there's a lot of families, a lot of guys bring their families out. And I'll tell you, and it's a lot of fun watching the little kids run around the camp. They're in period costume as well, and they're running around having a great time. And I'm thinking, you know, what better way could there be to you know, introduce children to history without getting too deep into it, you know, but just the whole be outside, run around. I remember when I was a kid, I'm building tree houses, playing outside with my neighborhood buddies and everything. And so the same thing, same kind of thing with the reenactments. The families show up, they see each other once a week or once every month or something like that. And the kids see their old friends again, just like we do.
So it's not so strict in the reenactments that you're typically a part of, that it has to be the right number of people, the right ages of people, the right color of people, the right gender of people. I mean, can women participate? Can people of color who might not have been participants in these battles participate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can be a little more flexible at the local regional events, but when you get to the national events, you find that they're a little bit more strict in terms of how you police your camp, you know, i.e. meaning don't leave a can of Pepsi or something laying around. You can put it in the little thing that I brought here today, that this particular cup here. You can pour your soda in it if you want. You know, no one will know the difference, you know, but the
but really you should be having mead in there.
Well,
or something.
I mean, you shouldn't be drinking during the day at the events. And generally we kind of hold people strictly to that rule. But
well, that's inauthentic, isn't it? I mean, didn't the soldiers get a ration of rum?
Well, we might have been on the British side, you know, and maybe the Southerners might have had a little bit of moonshine or something like that. But, you know, try to warm themselves up during bad weather. But no, at the larger events, the nationals, they tend to be a little bit more strict, and they don't prohibit, you know, like women from being involved on the military side. They just require that they have to hide their femininity, you know, if you will. You know, they have to put their hair up under a hat, you know, and such like that. And it can get a little – the argument about whether it's allowed or not, the authenticity of it, can get a little contentious at times. But by and large, I mean, no one's trying to give anybody a hard time. You just have to kind of work within the rules when you go to a larger event. They're running that event for a reason, and it's to attract you know, it's big business, and don't want folks to kind of ruin that atmosphere, you know. So,
but at the smaller events, the more local events, that's not quite as strict.
Well, we try to be a little bit. We kind of go 50-50 or such, you know. I prefer to be a little bit more authentic myself if I can. You know, if you're at an event, if you're a reenactor, don't put your sweatpants on after 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Be a reenactor all weekend. You know, really, I don't think that's too much to ask, but that's my own personal opinion.
Do you stay in character all weekend? I mean, when you're talking to your friends who you now know from these activities and from doing these reenactments for years, do you guys talk about, you know, your truck or your job, or do you stay in character?
I think every once in a while somebody might talk about their truck or something like that after hours, just so that, you know, if there's no public around, they don't hear that. However, I think most of the conversations inevitably you get into, well, what if General Jackson was at Gettysburg? You know, how different would it have been? You know, and you'll get back and forth. Well, it would have been this, or it would have been that, back and forth, you know. But I think generally everybody's got a pretty good head on their shoulders about what should be and what should not be.
Well, tap that cup that you brought, and so that people can hear that you brought something. Yeah. All right. So what is that?
This is called a mucket. Some people call it a coffee broiler. It's a very versatile piece of equipment that soldiers had on both North and South. It can be used to cook. You can put a stew in if you want, or you can put in a beverage, whatever you want. And then you can put it in the fire. It's why it's got a handle on it. It's actually got a handle
Two kinds of handles. So you can pick it up from the top or like a mug handle.
Exactly. So I could put it in the fire like so. That's why it looks all kind of, smoke charred and everything. You can just stick it in the fire like that. And before you know it, less than 5 minutes later, your coffee's boiling. And there you go. That's why some people call it a coffee broiler, And then you can also attach it to your haversack. And if we're trying to sneak around the enemy's flank, we probably aren't wearing these because they make too much noise.
And what about the jacket that you've put on especially for us? We asked you if you could bring some stuff. Thank you.
Well, this is my commander's outfit, my commander's jacket. It's 100% wool. It's not particularly authentic because it's sewn together by a modern machine. You can tell that's one of the authentics would look at it and go, oh, I can see it wasn't made by a manual sewing machine, at the time. But as you can – it is gray. You can see where it's kind of faded in places because actually, it's the use of the jacket has worn out over the years. It has my command rank, Confederate, three golden bars, which signifies captain. And it's wool and it's warm. So if it's 100 degrees –
You're sweating.
You're going to be sweating for sure.
We've got more comments from people here who are involved in reenactments or want to talk about it. Gene says, I've been doing Civil War reenacting with the 1st Vermont Cavalry for almost 10 years. It's a perfect fit for me since I was a history major. But besides that, I've always been a horse person. My horse has become an excellent cavalry mount. He has no problems with cannon fire or shooting a gun off his back. Together, we've learned how to do a wheel, fight dismounted, and do a charge with a saber. We've traveled to Shiloh, Bull Run, Brandy Station, Gettysburg, and numerous other events locally and nationally. I've learned tons more about the Civil War with this immersion into the 19th century. And probably the best part is I've met lots of new friends all across the country who have the same quirky interest in this very unusual hobby. And as an aside, we are always looking for more to join the ranks, Gene says. Sharon says, our family joined a Revolutionary Era group well over 10 years ago. We had attended an event at the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum, and they begged to try out life in the 18th century. We sewed and borrowed appropriate clothing, then spent a weekend as guests of a local unit, and we were hooked. Reenacting became a regular family hobby and gave our kids so many novel and enriching experiences. Eric, who works at the Modern Interpretive Department of the Living History Association based in Wilmington, Vermont, wrote, I'm more familiar with Second World War events, which can range from a dozen to a couple hundred, complete with tanks. A lot of people don't realize that reenactments don't stop at the American Civil War.
That's true. That's true.
And let's go to Bill calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I have an uncle who actually returned from Andersonville in one of the original prisoner swaps. And 6 months he spent fattening himself up and returned to service. His parole. So I have a great heart for what you folks do. I'm curious, it's sort of a two-part question. One is some more information about how people can learn how to get involved and learn how to be reenactors. But I also wanted to make a comment that if we reinstituted and reinvigorated our ancient traditional militia system, every single citizen of able body between 16 and some odd age, between 45 and 60, would be, in fact, quite intimate with the things that you take for granted in your reenactment, being able to drill, understand weaponry, firearm safety, and so on and so forth. As you can tell, I'm a Second Amendment activist. But I would encourage the reinvigoration of the militia system to achieve the goals that you're gaining. You're getting this experience that is incredible and certainly helpful to the defense of the country. So I appreciate what you do, and I'll take my comments off air.
Yeah, Bill, thanks for your thoughts. Some comments there about tying it to modern-day life, but Bill also wanted to know about learning the skills of reenactment.
Well, that's a very good question. He asked, how one could be involved. And the neat thing about the Champlain Valley Historical Reenactors is that we're local, and local meaning here in Vermont. And we have guys from all over the state, you know. And the association actually is composed of a civilian auxiliary, a medical detachment, the 1st Vermont Cavalry, which you just read a note mm-hmm. from those guys. Awesome. Anyway. And the 2nd Mississippi. Now, then the 1st Vermont Infantry is the 2nd Vermont Infantry. And so when you join the CVHR, you get access to all of that. You can be blue one weekend. You can be gray one weekend. So we aren't necessarily – I'm not necessarily 100% Confederate all the time at an event. We galvanize, what we call galvanize, which we'll put on the uniform of the other side. And so you can access all of that. So you can learn what it's like to be a Union soldier. And as part of that education, when new folks come in – we help them out. We loan them clothing because, you know, there are some aspects of the hobby that are expensive. The musket, for example, can cost, you know, upwards of, depending on what kind you get, it can cost $800, mm-hmm. you know.
And are these typically black powder muskets that you're
yeah.
using?
Mm-hmm. Well, the authentic replicas, you know, that would have been appropriate for the period. And, you know, there's used equipment out there, of course. There's tons of used stuff you can get from eBay. And we guide them along. We drill and we show them what position they should be, how to do the manual of arms, which is very different from the manual of arms in the modern army, what the commands are and such like that. So, yeah.
We got a note from Bob who says, rule number one for battle reenactments, always die in the shade.
That is so true. Well, if it's 95 degrees outside and you have access to a tree – and you want to take a hit, what we call taking a hit. Yeah, figure it out and take it there because otherwise you're going to, you know, that is, it's not fun when it's 95 or 100 degrees and you're just steaming because you don't know how much longer the event's going to last, the actual battle scenario is going to last. You might be roasting for a long time.
So that really is an unwritten rule. Go ahead and die in the shade.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you have access to it, but it's not like, well, those guys are all, they're all, died around that tree right there.
There's a pile up of guys under the tree. Right. Yeah, maybe not. You mentioned that you sometimes switch sides, you galvanize. Mm-hmm. Are there battalions or battles that people really don't – that you have a hard time filling that people don't want to be a part of? Or is it generally pretty spread out? I mean, do people want to be rebels? Do they want to be
– Well, Gettysburg is actually the one event where people definitely have roles they want to play. Everybody wants to be the Confederate, the few – Confederates, mind you, that actually get to the wall and get over the wall. And no matter what the organizers try to do to, you know, control that, at every Pickett's Charge that I've been to, there's always more guys getting over the wall than they should be. You know, I don't know how do you control it or whatever. And but no, there are depending on what the scenario is, like Antietam going through the cornfield, everybody would want to be the 2nd Mississippi and be a part of the Texan charge that went through the cornfield there. We have those moments that we're looking for.
Well, Steve Smith, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about your involvement with reenactment, really bringing it to life for us and sharing your enthusiasm mm-hmm. for it. I appreciate it.
Can I just share one other thing real quick? I'll be brief. The question came earlier about how we honor those that came before. I would like to stress that the Civil War had 600,000 casualties. That's more than all of our wars combined. 23,000 casualties at Antietam in one day is almost four times what we suffered at D-Day. Those men gave a lot, both sides. They believed in what they were fighting for. Regardless of the politics, they believed strongly. And that should be remembered.
And that's part of what you do.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Steve Smith is a member of the Champlain Valley Historical Reenactors, and he's the commanding officer of the 2nd Mississippi of the 9th Battalion of the Army of Northern Virginia. Thank you so much for talking with
You're
us
welcome.
Today.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
Coming up, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk with the Vermont Health Department. They're going to fill us in on a couple of viruses we should be on the lookout for here in Vermont in modern day. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, students on the football team at North Country Union High School were stopped in their tracks by a mysterious rash on their feet and hands. Hand, foot, and mouth disease is actually more common among children under 5 years old, but it can affect adults too, and it's more common at this time of year. Here to fill us in on the details of hand, foot, and mouth is Dr. Brina Holmes, the Director of Maternal and Child Health at the Department of Health. Dr. Holmes, nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane. Happy to be here.
Parents of small children in daycare or preschool are probably intimately familiar with this viral illness. Were you surprised to hear that a football game had been called off because of hand, foot, and mouth?
I actually was on some level, but you described it well. It's extremely common virus, much more often seen in young kids, but we see it in all children and adults as well.
Hand, foot, and mouth, its name suggests some of the places where the symptoms appear. Can you describe what the illness actually is like?
Sure. So this is a very common viral illness, extremely contagious, as you described. It is named after the places where you see tiny blisters in the mouth and fingers and bottom of the feet, but it also has the symptoms of regular old runny nose, sore throat, cough, and fever, and occasionally vomiting, diarrhea, although less common.
And how is it transmitted from one person to another?
So most commonly just respiratory, from folks coughing and sneezing, but it's also passed by direct contact, so people touching surfaces that have been contaminated with the virus. And then we also see it very commonly passed through stool, so diaper changes without hand washing, and young children who aren't as quite as hygienic in the bathroom.
One would hope that's not quite as much of an issue at the high school level, but you never know. This illness isn't usually terribly serious, right? I mean, this is a kind of a hassle and can be uncomfortable, but it's not something that's usually a deep concern for healthy people.
That's right. No, when young children get it, the blisters in the mouth are quite troublesome. They do struggle with sometimes eating and hydration. So that's been my experience as a pediatrician, is that it can be prolonged mouth pain, but not serious.
Why is it more common at this time of year?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. This is, and that might be better for epidemiologists, but it is a part, hand, foot, and mouth is caused by a group of virus called the enteroviruses, and they have this predilection for summer, late summer, early fall. So unlike some of the other viruses that we're used to seeing in the winter, this is our back-to-school virus.
Oh, joy. So this is great for many people. So the best ways to prevent it, you mentioned cleanliness, a big one.
Oh, God, it's just so basic practice of good hand washing, and also with the special attention to anything involving diaper changes or the bathroom.
I want to mention, just because it probably seems incredibly obvious and annoying to you to have to get this question, but I can't tell you the number of people who have mentioned it to me. This is totally separate from hoof and mouth disease, which affects cattle.
I'm so glad you asked that, because that is a universal truth that folks get confused, and I really don't know why. I think hoof and mouth, as you know, is a disease that affects cattle and sheep and swine, and I think some folks call that foot and mouth instead of hoof and mouth, which leads to the confusion. Humans don't get foot and mouth, and animals do not get hand, foot, and mouth. So thank you for asking that.
Right, so you have no worries going to the barnyard. You're not going to get hoof and mouth.
No, not the disease of cattle.
As you mentioned, hand, foot, and mouth disease is often caused by one of the members of the enteroviruses, and usually by a Coxsackie virus, which is in that family. But it is occasionally associated with an enterovirus, which can also cause those types of symptoms. And the health department recently sent out an alert about a rarer and potentially much more serious enterovirus. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, so that's actually completely separate. I mean, I think without being a virologist, it is the broad class of enterovirus, but this is a respiratory pathogen that we have not seen in Vermont. It is, there are no confirmed cases. It is present in New York right now and other neighboring states, but not New Hampshire. And it causes respiratory symptoms, not a rash, and is it's a difficult virus because it starts out looking like a traditional respiratory benign illness, but it can rapidly progress to more severe symptoms, especially with children with underlying respiratory concerns like asthma. So you can see children with labored breathing and wheezing and become quite ill. So, but I like to talk about it completely separately from hand, foot, and mouth because it really, there is no overlap.
Right. Yeah. No overlap. But this is something that you want parents and health people and school people to be on the lookout for because it has caused problems, breathing problems, respiratory problems for children in other states.
That's right. So it would be the child that is not recovering quickly from a regular runny nose cough or is exhibiting any signs of difficulty breathing.
And in that case, call your pediatrician?
Absolutely. Straight to the pediatric office for evaluation.
Dr. Brina Holmes is Director of Maternal and Child Health at the Department of Health. We have a link to the department where you'll find information on hand, foot, and mouth disease and enterovirus. Go to vpr.net to find that. Dr. Holmes, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
VPR has launched a new online music project called Live from the Fort. We invite Vermont bands into the VPR performance studio here at Fort Ethan Allen to perform and talk about their music, and we're posting the videos of these mini concerts to VPR.net. Today, we're sharing a track from Brett Hughes and his band playing Sweet Little Bird.
One, two, three. Sweet little bird, singing out there in the pines, a song as blue as summer skies, like this lonesome heart of mine. A dove, a whippoorwill, a sparrow's lonesome melody. Won't you sing your song to my dove? Send her running home to me. Sweet little bird, go and find the one I love. Her back home to me, guide her to me from above. A dove, a whippoorwill, a sparrow's lonesome melody. Won't you sing your song to my love? Send her running home to me.
Send her running home to me. Sweet little bird, go and find the one I love. Sing her back home to me, guide her to me from above. A dove, a whippoorwill, a sparrow's lonesome melody. Won't you sing your song to my love? Send her running home to me. Won't you sing your song to my love? Send her running home, home to me.
That was Brett Hughes, along with Pat Wright, Pat Melvin, Lowell Thompson, Leon Campos, Brett Lanier, Sean Priest, and Caleb Elder performing in VPR's online concert series, Live from the Fort. Go to VPR.net to watch the video of the full set the band played and hear them discuss their music. By the way, we would love your feedback on Live from the Fort and your suggestions for bands that you want to hear. Post your comments on that to VPR.net. We're also still getting comments on our earlier discussion about reenactment, military and historical reenactment, why people do it, what they get out of it. Mike wrote in to say, I've been with the Champlain Valley Historical Reenactors since the inception as a member of the 2nd Vermont. My whole family has been involved. My boys grew up in the unit and shared in our love of history, and they're now adults. But the best way to learn history is to live it. The members of the units I belong to are like brothers, and the special moments we've shared around the fire and on the field can't be beat. And Rachel wrote in to talk about the St. Albans raid. There's a reenactment happening this weekend in commemoration of the 150th anniversary of the raid. She says, I live in St. Albans with my husband and three kids, ages 9, 7, and 4. Back in the spring, my daughter's third grade class went on a walking field trip to the St. Albans Historical Museum. I had the opportunity to go with them as a chaperone, and I was amazed at all we learned while at the museum. It sparked an idea to have my kids and some of their friends attempt to do their own reenactment. So we had a junior Raiders drama camp over the summer months. It was an eye-opening experience to discover how much work goes into the planning and execution of some events. Keep those emails coming to us. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net. And make sure you tune in tomorrow. Bob Kinzel's guest on this program will be Republican congressional candidate Mark Donka. Donka won a close three-way race in the Republican primary and now faces Peter Welch for the second consecutive time. We'll hear where Donka stands on the federal budget, the Affordable Care Act, and immigration. Send your questions or comments for Mark Donka to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Our show is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Isla Yersel. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.